First Kings chapter 7 under the title of Building a Nice House. Last week we read of Solomon's work in building the temple, and I wonder if we might just begin our reading with the last verse of chapter 6 and go on into chapter 7. The last verse of chapter 6 reads like this: "The foundation of the temple of the Lord was laid in the fourth year, in the month of Ziv, in the 11th year, in the month of Bul, the 8th month. The temple was finished in all its details according to its specifications. He had spent 7 years building it. It took Solomon 13 years, however, to complete the construction of his palace. He built the palace of the forest of Lebanon, 100 cubits long, 50 wide, and 30 high, with 4 rows of cedar columns supporting trimmed cedar beams. It was roofed with cedar above the beams that rested on the columns, 45 beams, 15 to a row. Its windows were placed high in sets of 3 facing each other, and all the doorways had rectangular frames. They were in the front part in sets of 3 facing each other. He made a colonnade 50 cubits long and 30 wide. In front of it was a portico, and in front of that were pillars and an overhanging roof. He built the throne hall, the hall of justice, where he was to judge, and he covered it with cedar from floor to ceiling. And the palace in which he was to live, set further back, was similar in design. Solomon also made a palace like this hall for Pharaoh's daughter, whom he had married. And all these structures, from the outside to the great courtyard, and from foundation to eaves, were made of blocks of high-grade stone, cut to size, and trimmed with a saw on their inner and outer faces. The foundations were laid with large stones of good quality, some measuring 10 cubits and some 8. And above were high-grade stones cut to size and cedar beams. The great courtyard was surrounded by a wall of 3 courses of dressed stone and 1 course of trimmed cedar beams, as was the inner courtyard of the temple of the Lord with its portico." Amen. May God give us understanding. Last week Martin took us on a tour of the temple that Solomon built, a sign and symbol of God's presence that reminds us that God is characterized by glory and holiness and beauty. Approaching him is not an easy thing. Only God can make a way. And much of chapter 7 is taken up with further detail of how that temple was furnished and the materials to bring that message of what the presence of God was like home to the people. But the first 12 verses of chapter 7 describe the palaces that Solomon built for himself. Right in the middle of this description of his work in building the temple is this description of the palaces for himself. One commentator I read this week said this: "He was concerned to put God first because he built the temple first and finished it more speedily. His own house came second, and he was not in so much of a hurry to build it." Do you think that commentator was right? Well, the story is by and large told by the author of this book without comment. And so I sense, in one sense, perhaps we can say that's a fair interpretation. But it's surely right to read this story in the light of what follows. And reading between the lines, one senses that the author of Kings thought differently of Solomon's motives than that particular commentator did. Let's look at some of the facts of these two buildings that he established. First of all, consider the amount of time spent on each project. 7 years building the temple. However, that's a pretty crucial verse, I think, or word that the writer uses in the first verse of chapter 7. It took Solomon 13 years to complete his palace. I think he puts the two side by side quite deliberately so that we know how much time he spent on one, the temple, and how much time he spent on the other, his palace. But then consider the size of each project. We're told that the temple was 60 cubits long, 20 wide, and 30 high. The palace, we're told, was 100 cubits long, 50 wide, and 30 high. Now, if my maths are right, that means in volume the palace was 4 times the size of the temple. Plus, a colonnade of another 50 by 30 cubits, plus a hall of justice, plus a palace for himself to live in, plus a palace for his wife to live in. So that you get an impression that Solomon's palace buildings totally dwarfed the temple of the Lord that they sat beside. And then consider the materials for the project. We're told that the cedars of Lebanon were used in the temple. But the palace is called the Palace of the Forests of Lebanon. And you get the impression that they took just about every standing tree that was left and incorporated it in the high quality finishes of these palaces. The stones are described as high grade in verse 9. I have to say, I never thought I would be grateful for having to attend these building committee meetings over the last few months. But I think I've understood this chapter better, because I think I've heard the word dressed stone at a building committee meeting. And I've got a sense of something of the technicalities of this chapter. The palace was eventually more overladen with gold than the temple, if you read on. And then the workers. Well, we're told that 30,000 labourers were conscripted to build the temple, and they worked in 3 shifts. They worked for 1 month away from home in Lebanon and in the stone quarries, and 2 months at home. And we get a sense that they did that for those 7 years quite happily. But then they're kept on to build Solomon's palace. And if you read further on a chapter or two, you discover their unrest and resentment begin to build up amongst these conscripted labourers. They sense that there's a different aim, and it's not altogether an aim that they're happy to work for. So I think on the balance, we have to say that one commentator, who I have to say stands out from all the others, probably got it wrong. That Solomon took longer to build his palace because somewhere along the line it had become more important to him than the temple. Well, there's not a lot directly in the text that we might pick out tonight, but I think there are some broad lessons from Solomon's building projects for us to take, and let's work through them one by one. First of all, Solomon's story reminds us that there are 2 ways of building. Not a fast way and a slow way. Not a big way and a small way.
but a way that is God honouring and a way that is self promoting. We can either build in a way that glorifies God, or we can build in a way that magnifies ourselves. And the buildings described in chapter 6 and 7 fall into those two categories. We have to say that the way we build is not necessarily determined by our attitude. Great sacrifices were made by people for both projects. And we have to say the way we build is not necessarily determined by our materials, because quality materials went into both projects. But one building pointed to God and magnified God. The other drew attention to Solomon and brought him great honor. Two ways of building are distinguished by the one for whom we are building. So which way are you building? And who are you building for? It's not an easy question to answer. But here's a little tester. If you read through chapter 6, you'll find God's name mentioned on several occasions, God's voice heard on several occasions. Read through those 12 verses in chapter 7 that we read tonight, and God's name is mentioned only once, right at the end, the temple of the Lord with its portico, and his voice is never heard. So if you find yourself often with the words my and mine on your lips, that's a fair indicator of who you're building for. But if the words God and Lord are on your lips, as they will be in your place of prayer, that's a fair indicator of who you're building for. Two ways to build. Which way are you employed in? Secondly, Solomon's story reminds us that the way we build determines the way we live. It would have been possible to establish these buildings in different proportions. The temple could have been different, but more easily, the palace could have been different. It could have been smaller. It could have been more simple. There were no architect's plans that said, you must build your house this size, Solomon. Solomon chose the measurements and he established the size. And once the die was cast, there was no going back. A palace that size had to be filled and furnished. A palace that grand had to be showcased with suitable treasures. And a work that great demanded certain sacrifices of people and put certain pressures on relationships. And I think it's important for all of us, not least those who might consider themselves at the beginning of the building of a life, to realize that most of the crucial decisions of life are made at the building stage. You buy a big house, and that determines that you'll work big hours to pay your big mortgage. You aim high in the workplace, and you'll almost certainly have to pay a high cost to get there. The way we build determines the way we live. So when we start to build, we have to think about the way we want to live. And it's a complete fallacy to say that once we build a life or a career, once we're established, we'll give ourselves to hospitality or to Christian service or to generosity, if we don't build those things into our lives at the foundations, we'll never practice them, and they'll never be part of what we build. So the way we build determines the way we live. Thirdly, I think Solomon's story should prompt us to ask, what are we building? What are you building? What are we building? Let's ask that of ourselves first as individuals. We spend a great deal of our lives building a career, building a reputation, building a business, building a bank balance. And yet many of these things that we spend a great deal of time building last for no time. They're all subject to the ravishes of this life, to inflation, to rust, to time, to mortality. And those who are pointed out to us in the Bible as great examples of the kind of faith we should seek to embody in our own lives, in Hebrews 11, we're told they all looked to something else, to a city whose architect and builder is God. And the same writer says to us as Christians that we do not have an enduring city here, but we're looking for the city that is to come. In other words, it's one of the characteristics of living faith that our focus is not in building something which lasts only this life, but looking to things of eternal significance. We're to fix our eyes not on what is seen, but on what is unseen. For what is seen is temporary. What is unseen is eternal. And such people who have the right focus for their lives, who understand what lasts to eternity, are described as being strangers and exiles in this life. We don't need to look far to understand what a stranger and an exile lives like now. Our city is full of them. People in exile. People of an uncertain tomorrow. They don't have the same priorities in their life that those of us who've settled down here have. They spend their time differently. And they value different things. And those who are strangers and exile on earth, who are looking for the city that is to come, are different from those who've settled on this earth and are seeking to build something impressive in this earth. So what is worth building? What lasts? Well, it's worth building a character. Character lasts. Apostle Peter said, make every effort to add to your faith goodness, and to your goodness knowledge, and to your knowledge self-control, and to your self-control perseverance, and to perseverance godliness, to godliness family kindness and love. It's worth adding these things, because those are qualities that are characteristic of God, and they last eternally, and that kind of character lasts. Death doesn't take it from us. Inflation doesn't eat it from us. It's worth building character. It's worth building a relationship with God. We've just sung about our desire to know Christ. We were thinking of Paul as we introduced that song. And he sensed that everything that once he'd valued in this world had become valueless compared with this great desire to know Christ. And it's worth building a relationship with God, because that lasts for eternity. It's worth building obedience to Christ. For in a way that perhaps is beyond our capacity to understand, that establishes for us treasure in heaven. Jesus said to the rich young ruler, "Sell all that you have, and you will have treasure in heaven." Because doing what Jesus tells us to do builds up our bank balance of spiritual capital in heaven. So it's worth building obedience. And it's worth building a CV of faithful service to Christ. That's a CV worth building. Not so that we can wave it at the gates of heaven and say, this qualifies me to get in here. But because the Apostle Paul tells us in 1 Corinthians that such faithful service is rewarded in heaven. When we build with gold, silver, and precious stones, things of eternal quality. So that is a CV worth building. You maybe think I'm naive. You don't understand, David, the need to build businesses. The need to build security. Well, I maybe am naive. But I think you may need to point the finger at Jesus as well. Because in more than one occasion and in more than one story, he warned us about people who had built businesses and built bank balances, but had built nothing of eternal significance. So what are you building? Where is your time and your energy and your focus? Is it building things that last, or things for this moment only? And then what are we building as a church? The Apostle Peter says, we are being built into a spiritual house to be a holy priesthood, offering spiritual sacrifices acceptable to God through Jesus Christ, a people belonging to God, that we may declare the praises of him who called us out of darkness into his marvelous light. We're not in the business of building something that will cause others to look in wonder and bring us honor, as they did with Solomon and his palace. We are in the business of being built into something that will bring praise to God. It's not an empire like Microsoft, or a dome like Greenwich. It's a spiritual thing, pleasing and acceptable to God. In the last couple of years, we had opportunity on holiday time to visit a couple of churches which in former years had big reputations. They were what I call cutting edge churches. They were at the forefront of everything new. They were the places people flocked to see what was contemporary and what was exemplary. But I was aware that both of these churches didn't seem to be getting any publicity now. Their names weren't in the magazines. Their leaders weren't top bill at the conferences. I found the visits interesting. One we found to be modern in style and worship, in name and approach, but almost spiritually vacuous and casual in their attitudes. The other had an almost tangible sense of the glory of God in worship, and a real sense of holy love permeating the relationships between them. It's relatively easy to build something that attracts praise and attention, to build a name and a reputation that counts for something in this world. But to be built into something that is to the praise of God is costly and consuming. And I sensed as I visited those two churches that one of them had a refuse to pay that cost and to allow that to happen. And what once had been very fashionable about it, like every other fashion, had gone out of fashion and people had wearied of its human attractiveness. The other place I sensed had paid the cost and been consumed by the desire to become a people pleasing to God. Interestingly, they no longer were drawing great attraction from this world. But God was in the midst, and I'm sure His smile was upon them. We are being built into a spiritual house. Builders' yards are messy places, you know. Rough stones have chips knocked off them as they're carved to become a fitting shape. You remember that when you get frustrated with the person sitting next to you in the pew. This is a building yard. And God, if He's at work, is building us as stones into something that He appreciates. What are the signs and symbols of God's presence among a people? Well, they're not necessarily a big bank balance. They're not necessarily a massive crowd. They're not necessarily an awe-inspiring structure. They're not necessarily a name that attracts. But if God is present among His people, there will certainly be a sense of His glory, increasing holiness, reverence and worship, Christ-like concern for the poor and downtrodden. These are the signs and symbols of God's presence and work. So what are we building here? What are we concerned to be built into? Something that attracts praise, honor, reputation for ourselves, like Solomon's palace. Or something where the presence of God is real and manifest in our worship and in our lives together. Solomon's story should prompt us to ask, what are we building? Lastly, Solomon's story points to one particular danger. The danger of an acquisitive spirit. From the Garden of Eden, men and women have desired to be like God, and the desire to take to ourselves the wealth and honor and glory and power that the Song of Heaven tells us belong to God alone is a particularly dangerous and attractive expression of that desire. And Solomon's tendency to seek personal grandeur and pursue personal luxury ultimately distances him from a large and deprived section of his people and leads to their neglect and contributes to the downfall of his kingdom. And more people than we have time to mention have made shipwreck of their lives and their relationship with God because the desire to accumulate possessed them more than God did. You know, I think, to characterize something else, every packet of wealth should carry a health warning. The first danger of wealth is pride, as it causes us to look down on our neighbor. The second danger of wealth is materialism, where we come to enjoy the gift while forgetting the giver. And in the contrast to the person who sets themselves to acquire wealth is Jesus, who personally emptied himself of glory and humbled himself as a servant, who though he was rich, became poor for our sakes. And you and I, in the company of Jesus, need to learn and relearn and practice the grace, not of acquisitiveness, but of generosity and contentment. Do you know, in the United Kingdom today, 1 in 6 people give more than 50 pence a week to charity. That means 5 in 6 people give less than 50 pence a week to charity. In the UK today, the over 50s are twice as likely to give as the under 30s. And when they give on average £2 a week more. So if we are to learn not to be an accumulating people but a generous people, we're going to be swimming against the tide. And swimming against an increasing tide. Because giving is less characteristic of under 30s than over 50s. As a whole, Britain gives 0.25% of its gross domestic product charitably. That icon of acquisitiveness in our world, the United States, gives 2%. 10 times what we get. Yet both figures, in truth, are nothing but shameful. And so if we are to break free of the spirit of acquisitiveness that characterizes our society, it's going to take a great deal of decisive thinking and committed living. More than 20 years ago, evangelical leaders from around the world gathered to frame a commitment to a simple lifestyle, and they resolved then, and these words, I think, more now even than then need to be heard, they resolved to renounce waste and oppose extravagance in personal living, clothing and housing, travel and church buildings. They weren't calling us all to be ascetic, to live as monks or hermits, because they clearly said in their declaration, "We accept the distinction between necessities and luxuries, creative hobbies and empty status symbols, modesty and vanity, occasional celebrations and normal routines, service to God and slavery to fashion." Somewhere along the line, I think Solomon, if he ever had those distinctions, had lost sight of them. The palaces that he built for himself, the demands he made on his workforce, the time he gave to that which honoured himself and not God, all pointed to the fact that he loved himself and he loved to live in luxury more than he loved his God. He no longer knew the difference between what was necessary and what was a luxury, between modesty and vanity, between an occasional celebration and a normal routine. Life, routine, every day was filled with luxury as he built himself these great palaces. And his story points us to that danger, a real danger for each one of us. So as we finish tonight, I want you to consider these two buildings that Solomon built. And I want you to consider them as representative of two lives. Both cost a great deal. One magnifies God, the other magnifies self. One is characterized by the presence of God, that great privilege, God dwelling in us. It's filled with his glory, his holiness, his beauty. The other is characterized only by self-glory. What you and I have to realize is that the cost to realize one of those lives has already been paid. Christ paid the price at Calvary to allow us to have a life in which God dwells by his Spirit, to bring us to a place where our lives are characterized by his holiness. But to build the other will cost you everything. One is so magnificent it is worth sacrificing all to possess. The other is so temporary, it is worth paying nothing to obtain. Which of these two lives is characterized by these two buildings? Are you seeking? What are you building? What are you allowing God to build? The challenge this chapter presents to us. And God help us to recognize in which building site we're operating and what our lives are all about, ourselves or his glory. Let's pray together. Take our lives and let them be consecrated, Lord, to thee. Take our moments and our days. Let them flow in ceaseless praise. Take our silver and our gold, not a mite would we withhold. Take our intellect and use every power as thou shalt choose. Take our wills and make them thine. Take our hearts and make them thine own. May they be thy royal throne. Take our love For Lord, we pour at your feet its treasure store. Take ourselves, so that we may be ever only all for thee. Amen.